Best memory, I have a lot of them, but it's racing Matt Williams to church on Sunday mornings. I just want to tell Matt I beat him most of the time.
Old JL Mann High School was the nastiest place we ever were.
It was a little bit hard to be comfortable with your two-year-old and your newborn dropping them off in a hallway.
We would kill ants in the hallways before you drop off your three-year-old. We didn't tell people that because that's nasty.
And the first baptism, we basically dug a hole and lined it with plastic bags and put water in. I'm not sure if you went down if you felt like you were really clean.
They put her on the worship team once, like shaking a little egg thing.
I don't think we've ever spoken about that.
And actually had me running the sound.
So I showed up, third week we had been at Grace, and I showed up there and found out that I was not there to observe, I was there to play drums. So we practiced and we rehearsed, and I think I sort of got the songs. Yeah, 18 years later, I'm still playing drums.
I won't mention the name of the worship leader at the time, but he started going into talking about how great God was, and then he yelled out something like, "And that's why we praise his name!" And all of a sudden, the lights... And he was like, "Rah!" And everybody's like slammed back. It was unbelievable.
Trying to convert the city morgue into a Christian coffee house in a basement in downtown Greenville.
The funny names that we name our ministries at church.
Ezer.
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 I'm Ezering you. I'm Ezering you.
Yeah.
Flock groups. Are we going to flock? Be a flock together? Small groups. Growth group. Oh, you've got a growth. Let's go to that group.
Trying not to look at your hair in the aerobic room mirror.
You could look over and make sure you looked really nice.
At the YMCA, the heat went out. It was the middle of January.
You can't take off your coat because it's freezing. So you're trying to enjoy worship, but not look like you're freezing.
Patty Stallsmith has this huge parka. I mean, she looks like an Eskimo.
It was freezing in the wintertime, and you'd have to be prepared for anything.
I couldn't even see Sandy's face because she'd be in big hood over her head and big mittens on, trying to turn pages in the Bible with mittens.
Because it was truly freezing.
Tom Merritt doing the one-man nativity.
We were trying to inspire people to participate in children's ministry, so we were going to do a skit for the church. The one-man nativity scene, that went over like a bouquet of lead balloons. When I birthed baby Jesus out from under my bathrobe, I think that was a disconnect for some folks.
So we decided that we would take a men's retreat to the NASCAR. We dragged a full-size cooker, so when the race was over at 1:30, 2 o'clock, time for us to head home. We hooked the cooker back up. We didn't realize that no one had poured water on the coals. So we're heading down the road at 2:30 in the morning between Greenville and Charlotte, and there's a raging inferno pulling behind us in the truck. There's coals flying out of the interstate.
I mean, the very first time we met in our den, Tom walking around with the big camcorder like, We gotta record this. I mean, we're making history right now.
I'm like, if this thing works, we'll want this.
Yeah.
Here we are.
I know.
And we don't have the video.
Now we can't find it.
A good 90% of that's true. My name's Matt Williams. We are doing something a little different. I'm going to contradict what I said the last few weeks about the Bible. I'm not going to be teaching the Bible this week. I will show you a passage to illustrate the idea, but we are going to take a couple weeks this week kind of looking back at God's faithfulness, really more his mercy, and then what that means for us going forward for the, I'm not saying next 20 years, whatever. We're going to talk about how God has continued to refine the calling on us from the beginning, how it's the same and how it's changed. We'll talk about some of that next week. I am going to clarify, and I'm going to take issue with Joey Fowler. We did race almost every week from Furman. We lived in the same neighborhood, and we would race over to Pelham Road, and I'm telling you, we probably raced 100 times over 3 years. She may have won twice, maybe. And that's not machoism. I just have all these kids in the back screaming at me, "You cannot lose to her! Do not lose to her!" And Joey Fowler will run a red light on Sunday morning because not that much traffic. She thinks she got it figured out. She will run a red light. I've seen her do it, right? We would race through neighborhoods if the lights weren't timed out right. It was tough. We're going to look at kind of some of what we think God has done here. And part of that means I got to do a lot of talking. And so I have really pushed back on this idea for the better part of a year. And apparently I have lost. Back in the summer, we moved in May of 95 from Dallas, Texas, to Greenville, moved in with my in-laws. We had a brand new little baby, a couple months old, so they were thrilled about that. They didn't care much about us staying there, but they were happy to have Madison, so that was a good time for them. And then in June 4th of 1995, we had that first meeting that Tom and Allison was talking about, and he did record it, and I was mortified, but we can't find it, so it's gone. We're not worried about it too much. A lot of this started for me in college. I went to a retreat called, it's an FCA retreat, Fellowship of Christian Athletes. A guy was speaking from Denton, Texas, named Tom Nelson. And he stood up and he taught that weekend, and he taught from the Bible, and I had never heard anybody talk like that. I had never heard anybody explain the scriptures, take this passage and pull meaning out and hand it to you and call you to something. I just had not heard Bible exposition. I talked to him after a couple of the talks. I wanted more information. Who was he? What did he do? Where did he go to school and all that? And it just set me on a path of thinking, not that I wanted to teach, but that I had lots of questions. And I would go to people, pastors, leaders. I would go ask questions, and people didn't seem to have a lot of answers for my questions. And he seemed to have some answers. And so that led to me exploring some ideas about ministry. We weren't sure. Vicki and I got married. She graduated, but it was after my junior year at Clemson. And so we spent that year talking about, would I go in education? Would I go in business, kind of follow after my dad? Or maybe we'll go to seminary and just get some questions answered, and then who knows after that? So Tommy helped frame some of that discussion for me. We ultimately decided to go to Dallas Seminary, at least for a couple years. That's what we were thinking. And then we went to Denton Bible Church, which became formative for me. They let me rest a little bit from some college ministry we had been doing. Then they put us leading a group, and they trained us, discipled us, launched us into ministry. And that was a meaningful time. And something happened while we were there, as we were drinking up a new way of thinking about church and ministry. When I would go to church, I would corner the pastors, and I just had dozens and dozens of questions for them. I always had questions for them. And I didn't realize that that was something unique, a unique desire to kind of understand how church worked. And then we were on what we would call a community group leaders retreat. And it was late on a Friday night, and Tom stood up, and there was, I don't know, 150 folks in the room. And he started going around the room, and he said, "When I finish telling your story, you stand up." And he started telling stories of these people that were leaders in that church. And he told the story of who they were living with and what they were doing, what they were worshiping when they came to that church, and their process of coming to faith or coming to maturity and how God was using them. And he would tell this elaborate story. You would think, he's been watching Jerry Springer. And he would tell that story, and he'd go, "All right, stand up." And that couple would stand up. And you would think, well, he wouldn't be lying because they're right there. And he did that for about 45 minutes one night. And it's not until recently that I realized what a huge impact that had on me. Is that I got a clearer vision of what church was supposed to be. That people's lives are being changed. They're being reformed. They're being taken over. They're being invaded by God. They're being given new life. And then that is being leveraged to change other people's lives. And it just was one of a thousand things that I could share that just that began to grow in me, catalyze in me, get me to think. And then I was married to a woman who began to have ideas that she didn't talk about overtly. We'd drive to church. She's 23, 24 years old. And Vicki would say, she'd be like, "Gosh, we sure do go to a great church." I'd be like, "Yes, we do." She's like, "I'm telling you, you know, where we grew up, they just don't really have churches like this." I was like, "No, they don't." And that kind of conversation would go for months at a time. And then it would take another step. She'd be like, "You know, someone really should put churches like this back in the South where we're from." I was like, "Yes, they should." So ridiculous. And it just, the conversation just keeps following that path for the better part of a year. And you know, and then it would raise questions about what we're going to do. And so between some of the staff at Denton Bible, the small groups that we were leading, and my wife saying, "Hey, you should think about this." Some guys like Rusty Hayes and Charlie Anderson and Richard Brown and Kern White were guys that we would meet while we were in school, and we would talk about the idea of planting a church. I'd never even heard of it till I saw it out there. And so over the course of 3 years, I began to make comfort with the idea, make some peace with the idea that I would go plant a church for 12 to 24 months. I mean, how hard can it be, right? go knock it out, then I'll move on with my life. We'll get someone else who's a real pastor to be in charge of that, and I'll go do what I always wanted to do. We just got to figure out what that is, but this is what I'll do for a little while. And so, I mean, I'm young. What difference does it make? I'll give a year to 2 years of this. I mean, how hard can it be? Whip it into shape, hand it off. At the end of 18 months, I thought I would not give this to my worst enemy. I mean, this would be so painful to give this disorganized, chaotic mess to anybody. I would feel responsible forever that I afflicted them with something bad that I created. But before that, I went to meet breakfast with Tom Nelson one morning, and I said, how would you, I was thinking Atlanta, we'll go to Atlanta. And I said, how would you pick a place to plant a church? He goes, it needs to be a college town, and it needs to be a place where you will disciple people for 10 years, and then it fails. And you feel okay about it because you cared about those people and you invested in them. And it occurred to me on the drive back to Dallas that day, 30-minute drive back, that Atlanta's full of great people, I'm sure, but there were none there that I knew well or that I could say that I deeply cared about. But there were people that had graduated from Clemson and Furman that were here. There was some family here that we did care about. And so we said, I got back home. I was like, hey, what do you think about going to Greenville? She's like, well, since that's where I'm from, I think I'm good, right? And that's how spiritual we are, right? The story is really about God's faithfulness, or his mercy, faithfulness, that he would, you know, he would abide by what he said, but really he went and did some things that I didn't have a category for. So it's as much about just how merciful he has been to us and how kind and gracious, not to me, but to so many of us who've been around for a while. And so turn to Joshua 4. Let me show you a story where God calls his people to remember. We had moved here, and for a couple weeks, visited a few churches, get to lay the land. I didn't know that much about Greenville. Had a meeting, initial meeting at Tom and Allison's house in Easley. We were living in Easley, knew we wanted to be in Greenville. There was a couple that someone had put us in contact with that had moved here from Waco. And they had been a part of what's called a Bible church there. It'd be very similar to what we do. And so they were very excited. They'd call all the time. They're one of the main reasons we came. They're like, yeah, this place needs it. You could do it. Come on. We're so excited. They at least had seen what we were talking about. And so we got here, and after about 2 weeks into it, they called and said, hey, you want to come for dinner? It's like, sure. Going to make her fajitas and her guacamole, which was really good, by the way. But at that point, I was real naive, and I didn't realize that if someone has you for dinner, that may not be good. I just assumed that would be a good thing. I didn't have an idea. There's two ways that things can go. So we got into eating. He said, hey, my company's transferring me back to Texas. So in 2 weeks' time, I had shrunk the church by 40%. I thought, wow, another month or so, I'll be done. I'll write a book about how to start and end a church in less than 6 months. So that was all that. There's so many discouraging things and so many encouraging things. But when you step back and you see God's in control of all that, it's fascinating. Here's a place where Israel has left Egypt. They've wandered for 40 years because of their rebellion. They're going to cross the Jordan. And in crossing the Jordan, it's during a rainy season, so the banks of the Jordan are swollen. And so God gives direction to the priest to step into the water. When he does, the water rolls back all the way to the city of Adam. And so Israel's able to cross. So priests stand in the middle of the Jordan. Water's rolled back. They cross. It's like Red Sea, but a little different, right? And so let me show you verse 1 of Joshua chapter 4. And I'll just read a little bit. Just because it's God calling them to stop what they are doing and reflect and remember. Verse 1. When all the people had crossed the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, now choose 12 men, one from each tribe. Tell them, take 12 stones from this very place where the priests are standing in the middle of the Jordan. Carry them out. Pile them up in a place where you will camp tonight. So part of the mission becomes stopping the mission to remember what God has done. So some of us really like to celebrate. Some of us don't like to celebrate. This kind of remembering, celebrating becomes part of what God calls them to do. Verse 6. We will use these stones to build a memorial. So it's just going to be a stack of stones. So they have no meaning outside of what gets assigned to them. For those that have knowledge, that have awareness of what happened, there would be no meaning if you just saw the stack of stones. But because they've been built by this group of people, they do track with a story. You're remembering what God has done. And here's the difference. It's the difference between what God has done versus what you could do. So they're remembering Egypt. They're remembering, even though this group of people wasn't actually there, except for a couple. They're remembering Egypt. They're remembering fire by day and fire by night, cloud by day, manna, God's provision, this water being rolled back. They're remembering something. So this remembering is an act of worship. Remembering what? What you could not do for yourself and God had to do it. Verse 18. As soon as the priest carrying the ark of the Lord's covenant came up on the riverbed, their feet were on high ground, the water of the Jordan returned and overflowed its banks as before. So it's a miracle. Fits into the summer series, right? All the people crossed. Verse 21. Then Joshua said to the Israelites, in the future, a future day, when your children will ask, what do these stones mean? You will tell them, this is where the Israelites crossed the Jordan on dry ground. This happened. This actually happened. It's not just legend or lore. This actually happened. This is where the Israelites crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the river right before your eyes. He kept it dry until all were across, just as he did with the Red Sea. So it's part for the whole. It alludes to not just that moment, but everything that God's been doing up to that moment. And when he dried it up, they all crossed over. 24. He did this for a reason, so that all the nations of the earth might know the Lord's hand is powerful, and so that you might fear the Lord your God forever. That there'd be something that goes beyond this moment. When you see the stones, you remember something from the past, drive something for the future. And so a few things stand out to me. There's a next generation piece. That part of our story and part of remembering is for the next generation so that they would know. God's going to do things in their generation too. But part of what they expect in their time will be based on what they saw or we taught them from our time. It is part for the whole. It's not just about crossing that river. It's about the whole experience of everything that God has been doing. So I'm going to share a few things in a minute, and it's part of the whole, right? There's no way we could capture all that God has done. There's a testimony to the world. A couple years ago, I had a businessman corner me in a meeting from out of town, about an hour away. And he said, I did some research about your church, and I know a couple people that go to your church. And here's a couple questions that I have for you. I was like, okay, good. I like questions. He asked me two questions, and to both of them. The first one, he asked a question. I was like, I don't know. I don't really know. He goes, well, like strategy, vision, mission, all that kind of stuff. I was like, I don't know. I don't think that does it. I think we have some of that. I can tell you what some of that is. But I don't know that you can correlate that to what you're asking me. He goes, well, let me ask you another question. Ask me another question that related to growth or perceived success or something. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. He goes, well, do you help lead there? You part of the leadership? I was like, yeah. He goes, well, you don't seem to know a lot. I was like, well, I know a lot. I just don't know the answers to your questions. I said, because I can tell you a lot of things that we're doing. I said, I just don't know that what we're doing correlates directly to the questions that you're asking. Because what you're asking are questions of things that God has done that if I were to step into the middle and take credit, and I love taking some credit now, but if I step in the middle of that and say, oh, well, it's, well, we're real smart. Oh, well, we're real talented. Oh, well, we've worked hard. Well, we're real faithful. That's the thing, is that we're so godly and faithful. I mean, what choice does God have? I mean, he has to show up, right? I mean, you didn't leave, they're not good questions. How about that? You got to take a shot sometimes, right? He says that you might fear that there's this past, there's the present, there's the future, something about the past produces something for the future. It produces this worship, this recognition of that God is actually in control, that he's leading, and that it does predict the future. That if we can trust him in the past when we were that ignorant, and he came alongside and did this work, then now that we have a record of his work, how much more can we trust him for even greater things in the future, right? Because when you're going into the land for them, it's quite complicated. How are we going to defeat all these people? How are we going to deal with all this? Going to be hard. Well, the past kind of tells you, it doesn't tell you how he's going to do the future. It just tells you that he can rescue you, that he can create a place for you. Let me just give you a handful of things. And by a handful, I mean, you know, nine, two handfuls. I was going to make it 12 stones for 12 and that couldn't do it, right? And I've talked to our elders and some of our leaders and just reflected on a few ideas. On any one of these, I could probably talk for an hour. And I have talked for an hour at different times about some of these things. And then this is just a handful of things when there really are thousands. And this is just one person's perspective. So I'm just giving you one person's perspective of God's mercy, of his faithfulness to us. Let me just share. Some of these I'll say quickly. Some I'll elaborate a little more. One of those is that in the beginning, God created the earth. In the beginning, God gave us a unique group of people. I mean, you heard on the video. I mean, who does that? When they say it was cold at the gym, at the YMCA, I mean, it's really cold. So we had a couple of guys that their job was to go down at 3 in the morning. We had the security code, we had keys, we had everything, and to put these heaters in, like, right? They would put the heaters in, try to take the edge off. But they just put so much fumes out that you just felt nauseous by the time the worship service was over. So, yeah, you had to sit there in the cold, and it's true. I mean, Sandy Shaw was all bundled up, and you know, you knew that if someone needed to turn the page, you lost them. They're not going to turn the page because it was freezing cold. And I think about, you know, Rusty Gloss and Joey Espinoza setting up chairs, and in the summer one time, it was so hot in there because they didn't have AC. The heat worked better than the AC. We had big fans that would circulate the air. And so I wasn't teaching one weekend. That's when I did most of the teaching, almost all. And then, so this one weekend I wasn't teaching. I sat down beside Vicky and the guy's talking and I could hear like every fourth word because the sound was so bad and the fan was blowing. And I looked at Vicky. I was like, she's like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I got to go talk to the sound booth because I can't hear anything you're saying. She's like, well, this is the way it always is. And I said, like when I'm talking, like when I'm teaching, it's like this. Because I thought people were coming to hear me. So I don't know why people are coming. Because they're not coming to hear me. Because I couldn't hear anything I was saying. And so it's just a unique group of people that God was merciful to give us. Because it's not like they didn't have choices. This was a unique group of people who were willing to produce rather than consume. Because there was nothing here to consume. It was set up and tear down. I mean, it was cold and it was hot. And there was no bright, imminent future that everything's going to magically get better. There was none of that for 4 years. It was just grind. Right? It was just a grind. And there was, like I said, there was nothing to consume. It was just produce, give, sacrifice. That's all that it was. And their ability to endure incredible, naive levels of leadership and tremendous hardship. It's just fascinating to me. I just try to think, who would do that? And it's hard to comprehend. I don't totally have an answer for it. Another one is that there came a season where I realized that I wasn't really cut out for this. That I had mishandled a number of situations. I just did not have any instruction. I'm not socially intuitive. I'm not real aware of some things. So all that came by learning more skill than intuition. So I had mishandled a few things. And there were some people that were frustrated with me. And I legitimately, some of it was legitimate. Okay, so let's say half of it was legitimate, half of it was not. Even now with our young guys, when I sit with them and our young staff, whatever, I'll say, hey, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Listen to me. Here's how you want to do that. And I said, because if you do that, it'll go like this. But you go do this, it'll be so much better. I'll explain it to them. They'll come back. They're like, you're like a prophet. I was like, or a historian. Either one. Right? So I got confronted by some guys. It was a really painful experience. And I just thought to myself, it was a Sunday afternoon. I wrote in my journal. I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm going to go build a business I always wanted to build, or I'm going to go win a state championship in football. That's what I want to do. I don't want to do this anymore. This is dumb. Like, why am I suffering for something? I'm not doing this. This is crazy. This is nuts. I knew this would be crazy, and it actually is. And in that moment, starting in that moment for the next week, God began to pull back the curtains in my own soul and show me that I saw someone do it, namely Tom Nelson, but a few other people. And I thought, in ways that I didn't understand, that'll be easy. And there'll be some prominence with being on stage. And I didn't know I could teach till I was 25. So it wasn't like I was thinking, oh, that's just a natural. I mean, once I thought, oh, I got in front of some people and I was sick all the time because it was miserable. But I did have a... there was something would happen. So I learned I could teach, and I thought, oh, maybe that. And there was a part of me that thought it'll be easy, and there'll be some prominence in it. And I had some unclean motives on all that. And all that got clarified for me, that in some ways I had gotten in this for the wrong reasons. And then God said to me, and when I say God said, you know, I hardly ever say that. So I'm saying it. So God said to me, so now you get to choose. You want to do this for the right reasons because you honor me and you care for his people. And I thought, now that is interesting. Have to give that some thought. And it was a real purifying time to have to go back and reestablish motives and drive for why you do what you do. And it got clear to me that if this is what I want to do with my life, I had two goals. I had two jobs. One was to instruct. That was my job, was to instruct people. Not necessarily entertain, although sometimes I say something that's funny, but it was time to instruct and then to create a spiritual home for people. And what God did was he was gracious and patient with me to let someone who does not really fit in pastor world too well, to let me have this role. And I would go to meetings with other pastors, and then you talk about the odd man out, like I don't know what they're talking about. And they don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, I just do not fit in well in that world, right? I can pull it off now because I can fake it. But then I couldn't fake it. I didn't know, right? And so God has been patient and gracious to give me a role that I would traditionally not, there's no church out there that would hire me. In all these years, no one has ever come and said, hey, we'd like to hire you away from Grace to come. Not one time, 20 years. I mean, I think other churches look and they're like, no, we don't want that, right? He's just been kind. Another one is plurality of our leadership. We have plurality in our teaching, which has developed over time. We have plurality in our leadership from the very beginning. It takes a unique form of honesty and vulnerability to have a group of elders who lead in the way that ours do. And I'm not saying it's all perfect and it's all easy. I'm saying there's some real complicated, difficult things about it. But there's a unique kind of honesty and vulnerability, and especially our non-staff elders, they get this responsibility and they get no privilege. Usually you get some responsibility and you get some privilege. They get all responsibility and no privilege, right? And I have seen our elders, every one of them at different occasions, has had to take a personal hit for the greater unity of the board and for our church. They've had to go home at night and get in bed and their wife say, no, what did y'all decide? And he's had to tell her that and her say, what? What are we doing? And what made so much sense in the room when we were together, now you can't explain it to her. She's like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And you know this is going to be difficult for you, for your wife, for your family, for your friends, or whatever. All of them have had to take a personal hit to maintain unity. But God has blessed that. He's multiplied it. He's multiplied the influence and the impact. And in a culture, and even a Christian culture, that has taken cues from our world, that when it comes time to get something done or the pressure's on, you power up. You get stronger. And I would say that Jesus says that's actually not what we're doing. You power down into humility and vulnerability. And that's where his power comes through. And I would say on our best day, that's where God has given life to our church. And you say from the top down, then okay, yes, from the top down in that sense, right? Another one is, it's just such an interesting thing, church discipline. Now, we're all doing church discipline all the time. When someone has a conversation that challenges you, that's a form of church discipline. But we got to a place about 15 years ago where we had a guy who said, I don't want to be married to her anymore, and I don't have a good reason. And we worked and worked and worked, and we looked at Matthew 18, and Jesus said, go to them this many times, and go to them here, and go to them with this person, and go to them with the elders, and tell them. We went through, like, Jesus gives you like 4 steps, we turn into like 14. We begged and we pleaded, and he just said, I'm not, I'm leaving, I'm done, I'm abandoning, and I don't know. And so he just said, I am rebelling, and I'm not doing this. And so because of Matthew 18 and 1 Corinthians 5, we just said, you call yourself a Christian, yet you're going to live in open rebellion, then you can't be a member of our church. And so Jesus said, you have to put them outside the church. So that's what we did. So that night before I was given, and I alluded to this last week, before I got up to speak, I didn't sleep that night. And it was real painful. And I just thought, I mean, gosh, work so hard and this dude is going to take our whole church down? Because when I stand up and say this, I'd only heard of one church doing it, and it wasn't in this area. I'd never, no churches in this area doing it. I'm not saying no churches in this area had done it. I'm just saying no of any, right? And so I stood up, we did that. And this is the time where I went back to my office, and then I heard a knock at the door, and there's a line of people out there. And the first one, I said this in one of the Pelham Road services last week, but I didn't say it on video, so here it is. So it's Sherry Horner. She's frontline, and I'm thinking to myself, for real? Sherry Horner. Supposed to be about the Bible. Coming in to cut me into pieces, going to tear me up. I look close, she's crying. She grabs me. I was like, oh, she's going to stab me from the back. Oh, I watch you. I know what you're doing, little girl. She's so short, right? She's going to stab me, right? She says, I just want to say, she goes, I know this wasn't just you, but thank you for doing the difficult thing. And it didn't always work out like that, but boy, that time it did. And that whole line of people had all been wounded, and the church, in other contexts, had turned their head away while they got wounded by people sinning, and the church didn't address it. And so they were really grateful. And that was one of those where, now we lost some people out of our church. We're like, I can't be a part of a church that kicks people out. I was like, okay, well, every other organization you're a part of has rules and boundaries. And this one is the Holy Church of the Risen Lord. Okay, who's going to come back in judgment one day? I think we ought to think about this. He says, if you want to be a Christian, be a Christian. You want to be a Christian, don't be a Christian. But don't act like you're a Christian and then live in rebellion. Just pick your side. You can't do both, right? All right, you can't say one thing and do something else. So Jesus is pretty clear about that. But what it did was, we did probably lose some people, but it helped clarify for us. Help clarify what our calling and our mission was to make disciples and invest in people. So that kind of stuff doesn't happen as much as we can prevent it, and that we're to build people and love them and care about them, because that was a miserable experience. And though it still happens, we want to invest in people so that it doesn't happen, and it made us clear about what Jesus had called us to do. Another one that's important is we had a building given to us in 1999. And it was the Student Center and 5 acres on Pelham Road at that time. And the church had gone through some leadership challenges, and there was a couple elders left, and they were thinking about how to divide up the property and how to who to give it to, and there was just a random conversation with a gal who went to our church who knew that family, who said, you should think about Grace Church. There was a list of ministries in Greenville they were thinking about, and we were not on the list. We were unknown. And so they mentioned it, and they came and saw our service and then put our name on the list. And then they spent about a year talking to us and praying about it. And I can remember Thanksgiving in 99 in our house out in close to Furman, where I used to race Joey Fowler from and beat her all the time. And I would, I opened the door and I put the turkey back in. As I was sliding the turkey back in, I was like, Jesus, please let them give us that building. We're so tired of setting up. I mean, I'll never forget. Please, please, let this be the last Thanksgiving without a building. And a week or so later, Tom Proctor called. He goes, we want to give you the building. I know exactly where I was standing on the phone in offices on East North Street when he called and said, you can get to have that building. We talked, and let me show them to you. We got a picture of them. Tom and Betty. And so Tom, if you were listening closely, had a real funny sense of humor, but you had to listen closely, right? So I like that. It's kind of sharp. We were in the building talking, and he said, you need to pray about if you'd want this building. And I was like, I hate to be callous and unspiritual. I was like, we'll go do that. I said, but I guarantee you I know what God's going to say. I know he's going to tell us. So we can forget that formality. He said, all right. I said, we would have to redecorate this. I said, we have to do some, whether it's right or wrong, maybe it's just our pride, we gotta work on this building. I said, so what are the strings? He goes, no strings. He goes, you just do your best to fill it up with people. That's what he said. And I had never had, I just never expected an older man to say something like that. During that year, Cindy Chabera would come sit in the parking lot and pray. The day that we moved in, a family came that had been a part of the original church that was in that building. They're kind of fundamentalist. And as soon as someone hit the drums in the worship, they got up and stormed out in protest. They knew the whole time they were coming to protest. Like, he endured that for us. He never talked to me about any of that. He got scolded for giving us this building. He got ripped apart for giving it, and he never talked to me. I had to find that out in other ways. And so he took it for us, sacrificed for us. He got up at 4 a.m. and put on coffee for Men's Roundtable. We brought him in and said, hey, would you consider being an elder in our church? And he said, no. Like, it wasn't like, well, it was just like, no. He goes, I was an elder. I did that. He goes, whatever you need from me, I'll do. Except that. He goes, you want to talk about something? We'll talk about it. You got questions? I'll help you. I'll help you do anything, except I'm not going to do that role. He goes, this is what you literally say. He goes, it's your turn. But we would not be here. Humanly speaking, God could have done it another way, but this, what a strategic location that on Pelham Road that came to legitimize who we were as a church. A sixth one, God sent us a bunch of counselors throughout the years when we didn't know what to do. I could not count the churches and the people who've helped us, but some of them are a senior associate pastor at Brooklyn Tabernacle in New York, an executive pastor at Calvary Chapel, Fort Lauderdale, Larry Osborne at North Coast, Dave Travis at Leadership Network, Robert Lewis from Little Rock, Lloyd Shadrach from Nashville, Gary Brought in Greensboro. And then a friend of mine, Lloyd Shadrach, called me. He said, Matt, we've been here a little over a year. He said, there's a guy coming from Little Rock to Southside Baptist. I think that's in your town. It's now been changed to Southside, and now I can't keep up with all their names. But anyway, it's right down the road here on Highway 14. He goes, there's a guy coming to be the pastor there. His name's Charlie Boyd, and he understands a fellowship model of doing ministry. He goes, and you are young, which meant you're an idiot. So you should talk to him. And so when he got to town, I let him settle in. I took Charlie Boyd to lunch, and we sat and talked. I said, you know, I've been doing this a little over a year. I have no clue what I'm doing. And I just wonder if you have any advice. This is the craziest thing. He said, if I were you, I would call out to Fellowship Bible Church Little Rock to their bookstore and ask for the state of the church address for the last 25 years, and I would listen to those. And I was like, what's the state of the church address? He goes, every year Robert Lewis would just stand up, or Bill Wellens, they would stand up and they would just tell, here's what happened to our church this year, here's what we're going to do next year, here's what we think God's doing, here's what we're going to spend our money on, here, blah, 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 blah. He goes, usually they last about an hour, just get all the tapes and listen to them. Tapes were this little rectangular thing, right, that you could listen to, right? And I walked out of lunch. I went back to my office. I called. They mailed them to me. Some years had two tapes because they talked so long. Went past, you know, 50 minutes or whatever. And for 3 weeks, I drove around my car and I listened to those tapes. And I got to see 25 years of the creation and the evolution of a church. And it changed the way I thought about life. It changed the way I thought about the church. I went to seminary and they did not teach me a high value of church. But I listened to these tapes and I got a high value of church. And what it could do in a community and how people's lives could be changed. It was fascinating to me. And it was a dude called me, said you should take this dude to lunch. I went to lunch with him. He made a comment. It wasn't offhand, but it wasn't overly dramatic either. At any point, that ball could have been dropped. And it revolutionized the way we think about how we hire staff and how we rally people to a cause and to a mission and what we expect out of community group leaders. It's very interesting, very small thing that very few people would know about. And then we got stuck, and we had our 5 acres, and we had our building, and we had no debt, and we were so proud that we had no debt, and we were so self-sufficient in that. And so we brought in Bill Wellens, who had been a pastor in that same church, and he spent 2 days with us. And we sat in a room over off Pelham and 14, and we were talking, and he said, well, it seems like you guys have done a great job, and you're running 3 services, and you're kind of stuck, but you've done a great job. So here's my question for you. And we were not prepared for this. He goes, are you done? And we did not have an answer for that question as elders of this church. He goes, it seems to me that that's the thing you got to figure out. If you're done, then you're good. Just keep doing what you're doing. If you're not done, you got some really tough, difficult decisions that are going to unravel all that y'all hold dear. All your self-sufficiency is going to fall apart because you're going to have to get involved with raising money or going in debt or building buildings, all the things that you've avoided. Because what I didn't tell you was that the property at Pelham Road was originally 12 acres in a building. There was an L shape of 7 acres they cut out and they gave to Campus Crusade for Christ, particularly China. And they gave us the 5 acres. And so every other month, the realtor would call me and say, hey, you gonna buy that 7 acres? And I'd be like, no, please stop calling. I was like, why would we want more land? Why would we want the headaches of that? We're just a church. We're not in the land business. We're in the church business. So he would call, and I would be rude. I'd be like, Gerald, leave me alone. Gerald, stop calling. No. I wouldn't even talk to him, right? So I walked out of that meeting. We talked about his elders. I walked out of that meeting, and I called him, and I said, hey, we want that 7 acres. And he goes, you know, it's so interesting that you call. I was like, how is it interesting? He said, because there's been a moratorium on sewer on Pelham Road, and no one's been able to really buy or sell because you couldn't tap into sewer. He goes, so I've missed out on like 20 opportunities to sell that piece of property. He goes, and they just lifted that moratorium like a week and a half ago. He goes, and then you called today. So weird. I was like, which does raise the question why you're calling trying to get me to buy a piece of property that has a moratorium on it. Real estate people, right? But God's good. So I called Campus Crusade in California. I said, we want to buy that land. They said, okay, tell us the price. I was like, you don't want to give it to us? They're like, no. 7 acres. I said, $750,000. They said, we happen to know it's worth well over $1 million. I was like, oh, I thought you said how much were we willing to pay. You weren't asking me how much it's worth. Those are different issues. Yeah. I was like, this is what we can do. And they said, okay, send us a contract. Send a contract for like $750. They took it. We bought it. A year later, we sold 1 acre out of the seven for $425,000. I was like, hey, God, you're so good. You're so good to us. There's just so many things that you just do not see coming that he does. He's given us a unique leadership culture staff. Just a unique leadership culture. Our staff and our volunteers, particularly among our volunteers. We have, and I do not say this in a prideful way, although I am proud of it. I don't know how it happened, I don't know how we created. We have volunteers in our church who do the work that paid staff do in other churches. So when I meet with other pastors, like, well, this guy, he's in charge of all our missions in Africa. And I was like, oh, okay, so he's the pastor, he's on staff. They're like, yeah, they're like, how do y'all have a pastor? I was like, no, we don't. We have a dude. we have a guy named Jerry Fay who oversees Africa. We have a guy named Wes Cavan who oversees Nicaragua. We just have people. We have volunteers who have. They're like, no, well, our deal, we have a big budget. It's like $100,000. I was like, yeah, it's like $200,000. That's right. They're in charge of all the trips. Well, there's a lot of trips. I was like, well, our guys are in charge of trips. And so it's just a unique environment where we have this many people who carry real leadership weight and responsibility and that provide service for people where lives are changed because of the leadership culture. We launched our Powdersville campus without a pastor. We just said, you're the leadership culture. You're the leadership people. We don't know what we're doing. You're going to help us figure it out. And so we didn't even have a pastor when we launched that. And just to see the number of lives have been changed because of the leaders here that have sacrificed themselves. And then lastly, let me give you one more. There is a totally unanticipated consequence to all this. Is that there's a new generation, there's a second generation of leaders that are coming about and disciples that are coming about, and they are our physical children and our spiritual children. And you should have thought of that, and I know, and that's what we've been working for, but we hadn't been thinking that it was going to happen. And so when I have some people bump into me and say, hey, and they're talking about my physical children, hey, one of your children did this for me. They served me in the local church or out in the community. Hey, your daughter did this. Hey, your son did this. You just think, oh, a new generation of people creating influence for the kingdom. Right? And I'm not trying to brag on my children. I'm just saying I get it from your children too. Then they tell me the story. And so the idea that we've invested and now there's a new generation of people who are not just living in the shade that we've created. They're building out on that, going in new directions, doing new things, taking for granted some of what's been given to them and building on it. And then spiritual children, where we're bringing in young folks, interns, residencies, fellowships. We have people coming in that we get to invest in, and they get the benefit of what a lot of us did not have. Some training, some attention, the ability to grow and create influence. And like I said, they're not just living up underneath what we've created. They're actually growing beyond that, doing new things. Which Jesus said that's what's supposed to happen. Go make disciples of all nations. But that does start in your home. It does start in your local church. It does start in Jerusalem. And it's powerful to see it. And I'm thinking of Ephesians 3 as I'm working through this week. And I got really emotional this week by myself. And I'm so proud that I'm not emotional now. There you have it. All right. Because I thought, I'm going to get up there and be a big baby, and I'm so glad that I'm not. But then the weekend's not over. It says this: "Now all glory to God, who is able, through his mighty power at work within us, to accomplish infinitely more than we might ask or think." That within us and through us. That's the whole idea. And I have known that pastor since I was in college. But I'm going to tell you, I've been able to have a front row seat to some of this. And some of it I've been able to be in the middle of, and some of it I've been able to stand just to the side and watch other people in our church, watch what God has done. And it is mind-blowing what God has done in people and then has done through them, to be able to see it. It's more than I can comprehend at times. And this is just one person's limited perspective in just a few minutes talking about it. Because the thing it's kind of a tension that happens when you're involved in ministry, whether you're paid to do it or just, well, you're volunteering, whatever you're doing, is that on one level, what you're doing is so not about you. It's about the moment. It's about what Jesus is doing in these people, how you come along to serve, how your gifts and abilities and experience get leveraged to help somebody else. It's not about you. And then there's this other level where it's totally about you. Where Moses gets told to do something, and the leadership that he's providing for Israel, it is totally about what God is doing for his people. But it's also, like Moses, you can't kill the Egyptians. God can, but you can't do that. Your anger's got to be dealt with. There's this part that's not about you, and there's this part that's totally about this work, that his work in us beyond more than we can ask or think. It's incredible. Well, let me show you some of the same folks that we saw in the beginning. Let me let them speak again and hear the more serious side of some things that God has done. Let's roll that.
Well, as a family, we certainly feel like the word we always think of is grateful, how grateful we are on how God's provision, just being able to deliver from where we started to being able to provide a campus, buildings, worship centers, campuses now that we've expanded to. You really get caught up in thinking about how faithful God was to always provide those places.
We were at the size where we could think about getting a building, and we'd looked at several properties and all. And so we had kind of almost the whole church was in Matt and Vicky's house, and we were just talking and praying over what to do. And we were really not arguing, but just wrangling. We couldn't decide which way to go, hire someone else for staff or really pursue a building. And Terry Anderson looked up and she's like, "Y'all, we're about making disciples. We're not about, I mean, a building's fine, but we're about making disciples. And you don't make a disciple with a building, you make a disciple with a shepherd. So God can give us a building if he wants to." And it just like galvanized everybody in the room. It was just like, yeah, let's bring someone else on staff, you know? And then, yeah, a year later, he gives us Pelham.
From the time we came, there's been a vision to have a presence on the downtown, in the downtown. And started with a coffee house, through a bar on Stone Avenue, through Matt and some leaders were looking for a building on Main Street we couldn't afford. And Matt goes, "Well, maybe God will give us one." And of course, eventually, we were given a 150-year-old downtown Baptist. And so now we have a witness right down in the center of everything.
Charlie and I started attending way back in 95, and the twins were born in 95, so they've literally had one church. Just watching them be taught, trained, discipled, equipped, now they are able to serve side by side with even those same people that taught them. So that's just been a neat part of seeing the growth.
God has shown faithfulness to us because I feel that the leadership in the church has stayed the course of staying true to the Bible, staying true to discipling people and true to be committed in sharing in into each other's lives.
When I think of God's faithfulness through Grace Church, I think of how we started in missions, because missions is important to me. From what was a one-time-a-year medical trip to Nicaragua, it has become two medical trips a year, plus multiple pastoral training trips. Not only has our relationship with Nicaragua grown and been more purposeful and strategic, but now we're in Kenya doing some of the same things, and we're in Eleuthera and Papua New Guinea. It just is thrilling to see how God is working through Grace to impact other nations.
I think one thing I appreciate is just the opportunities that Grace has given people like us who've been here. You know, we came here young and not knowing much, and now we're able to serve and give back and be a part of the bigger mission.
So I've seen over the years that God has just been faithful. He has consistently shown my friends and I at Grace opportunities if we're just willing to take the risk to step out and use our gifts out in the world.
I'm a different person than I was in 96. And it's because of the people that invested in me, the teaching, and staying true to the gospel. And that's what continues to help Grace grow today, is because it's been true to the gospel and what Christ's mission is. And you can see it around. When you see the buildings, that's just the building. It's the lives that we've seen change throughout Grace Church in the history of 20 years.
What I think has been a consistent theme in the 20 years of Grace Church is that, you know, God has been faithful. I mean, He's been faithful through all of it. And it's just been neat to see, whether it's a church of 5,000 people or whether it's a church of 15 people, that God is involved and God has His hand in both of them.
We began to experience an opportunity to use the local church as the focus for us to be intentional about giving our life away, to use the local church as something that we oriented everything around, our marriage, parenting.
Church for us changed from being something that we just went to it being something that was a part of our lives.
That has been a blessing for us, that God has given us a sustained 20 years that has profoundly impacted who we are individually, who we are as a couple, who we are as parents. And now to watch our kids be young adults and live out their faith and want to be connected to the local church, I mean, that's just an unbelievable blessing that 20 years ago you didn't even know you were going to get the experience.